The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Professor Greg Sadler is the co-founder of Reason.io, a consulting company that puts philosophy into practice. The YouTube star behind the half-hour Hegel series, a professor of philosophy who's taught at Ball State University and Fayetteville State University, and the guest on this week's podcast. In this episode, you'll hear us discuss whether philosophy really has any practical applications, the reception he receives as a professional philosopher in the corporate sector, Stoicism, and the importance of philosophy overall. It's Thursday, February 15th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books. We're a day late this week, so my apologies. I want to thank the folks at the Across the Aisle podcast, as well as Michael G., Connor P., Jeremy C.M., and Greg M., for becoming patrons in the last week. We currently have 189 patrons, and our goal at the moment is to get 400 patrons. The more we get, the better these podcasts and our YouTube channel will become. I'm currently talking to an animation studio in London about getting help with the YouTube channel. I'm thinking about upgrading my microphone. I've used the same brand of USB microphone since 2009, and should probably get a more professional grade setup. And I eventually want to hire someone to help me keep up with editing this podcast. So if you're thinking about becoming a patron, you'll be helping to improve this podcast, the videos we produce, and you'll get to enjoy our membership podcast called Inside Zero Books. So go over to Patreon, sign up. If you haven't already, you might pick up Anselm Jappe's The Writing on the Wall or Ian Parker's Revolutionary Keywords for a New Left. This month's bestsellers, which means they recently passed the 500 book sold mark, whether for the first time or again, are as follows: Kill All Normies, Capitalist Realism, Porn Panic, Ghosts of My Life, Sweetening the Pill, Millennials and the Moments That Made Us, How to Dismantle the NHS, Artists at Work, Proximity of Art and Capitalism, that's one title, that's Artists at Work, Proximity of Art and Capitalism, Capitalist Superheroes, How the Establishment Lost Control, and Heavy Radicals. So you should go to pals.com, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, IndieBound, Hive, or your local library and get a hold of a copy of one of our books. In this episode, you'll hear a YouTube lecture on Stoicism, a clip of Isaiah Berlin talking to Brian McGee, and instrumental covers of the Indigo Girls' Closer to Fine and the Waitress's I Know What Boys Want. The music you're listening to right now is Enmesh's Leaving Hollywood, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Greg Sadler and I discuss how he brings philosophy into the world. So you're the co-founder of Reason.io, which it's a small business that aims to make the resources of classical and contemporary philosophy available to non-philosophers. But you were a tenure-track professor at Fayetteville State University. So how did you decide to leave academia and put up a shingle as a philosopher for hire?
Well, it was it really wasn't anything that I'd thought about doing back when I actually made that decision. I'd say that my fiance at the time and now my wife, and who's my co-founder of Reason.io and partner in everything that I do, Andy Shaka, she had a huge role in that. So, you know, as far as the motive goes, it's pretty simple. I did it for love because I was down in North Carolina at Fayetteville State University, where I was up for early tenure and promotion, and I was running university-wide assessment and critical thinking. And so, you know, I had some really great prospects. But she was up at the Culinary Institute of America, at that time founding their Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning. And we did that, you know, commuter couple thing for about a year and a half, and we decided that was terrible. And so, you know, it was either I go up there or she comes down by us. And you know, being a Midwesterner, I think I much rather wanted to go to upstate New York than to stay in the South.
Right.
And, you know, it was there were a lot more schools to work for. And I didn't originally think that I would start a business. I meant to just sort of adjunct, and I would, you know, work on my academic writing. So I've got book projects that never actually got finished because I got drawn in. And, you know, I started teaching for Marist right away and recording those videos in my classes. And I put a lot of work into my classes. So even though I was only teaching two per semester and then some online stuff, I was really investing a lot of time in building resources. So I didn't get to a lot of the academic writing that I wanted to do. And then things started coming my way. You know, Google offered the possibility of doing tutorial sessions with, I forget what it was called. It's now totally defunct, but it was something like a hangout where you'd get to charge. And I was like, yeah, okay, I could do that. And people were asking for it. And then that morphed into the tutorial end of the business, which is now going pretty strong. I have a lot of continuing clients. The philosophical counseling, I'd been doing stuff like that already on my own without getting paid for a number of years because the, you know, way I approach philosophy is very practical. So we thought it, you know, since it was down in the city, we bit the bullet and had me go get the training and certification, and then I started doing that and working with businesses. What else? I mean, the content production, you know, I was doing that through the videos, and I was involved in several different educational startups, which were all, you know, they all have the same line that they're going to totally revolutionize education. Very few of them survive. But I jumped into those. And so I started to get a bit more comfortable with being, as they call it, entrepreneurial. And my wife, you know, she was always that way. For me as a traditional academic, I had to get over the, well, aren't you like, you know, turning into a sophist because you're charging? And the answer is no, because who else is going to pay you, you know, if the state isn't going to pay you and an institution isn't going to pay you, well, then you've got to make a living for yourself and your family somehow. And as it turns out, you know, there's a lot of people who can really use the services that I offer. And it's kind of a small number of people with the skill sets that I've got. So there's not a lot of competition. Unless Google jumps into it or something.
Right. So, okay, explain to me who your clients are and when. You know, I love philosophy. I have a BA in philosophy, so I'm not an expert in philosophy the way you are. But I can't imagine who I would approach to be a client if I, let's say, I went back to school and could justify it, who I would approach to hire me to give them philosophical training and, I guess, not so much advice, but I tend to think and advice. But who comes to you primarily?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's actually an interesting thing. I have not done very much marketing at all. I'm actually still quite bad at doing that sort of thing. So it really has been people coming to me for the most part. I think having the video channel probably has been very helpful with that. And it's everybody from like CEOs of pretty sizable companies and other people on, you know, management or executive levels to healthcare professionals who want me to work with them to develop things in terms of, you know, medical ethics or practicing psychiatrists and psychologists, all the way to you know, sort of traditional students, you know, traditional age students who need some prep before a test, or they want me to help them with a paper, and then everybody in between. So I get a lot of lifelong learners who you know, either they went to college and they maybe took some philosophy and they're interested in it, but they don't know how to get back into it. So they, you know, they watch some videos and then they contact me, or a lot of people who just simply don't have the opportunity to go to college, but are interested in the world of ideas. And the thing that's been helpful for me is that I never realized this, but I have a kind of talent for taking complex philosophical ideas or distinctions and making them understandable without talking down to my audience or watering them down. And it turns out there's not a lot of people who can do that. There's a lot of people who can do the really high-end stuff, but then they can't connect with the audience, and there's a lot of people who can give you sort of bullet point popularizations, but then there's no meat there. And so the in-between is kind of tough. And I attribute that entirely to years and years and years of teaching intro ethics, critical thinking, these things we call service classes, you know, for non-majors. You have to be able to connect with your audience. And I think that I've actually got a video about this because it's something that I go on a rant about. I think that all professors ought to be required to teach undergraduates who are not philosophy majors, because it would be good for their teaching.
Yeah. I publish critical theory books, and I have often I'm encountering people who are either graduate students or recently out of university. Sometimes, you know, full-fledged professors who are submitting books to me for me to decide whether or not they're worthy of publication. So there's always a sort of an imposter syndrome that's going on.
Oh, yeah.
but at the same time, I often feel, especially in the realm of critical theory, that forcing themselves to take a 101 approach would not only help them connect to an audience, it would help them to avoid errors.
Oh, yeah.
Often enough, you know, if we go back to some basics, if we say, okay, let's trace Foucault back to Nietzsche and Kant and think about the original arguments, that you will have an easier time understanding the nuanced arguments or the higher level arguments, and that sometimes that gets lost. There's sort of a tendency to sneer at the 101 level of philosophy, but yeah. I think it's important.
Yeah, I'll actually say two things about that. So one is that you're right. You want to be able to reconstruct what the argument is and not have to rely on lots of jargon to fill in the picture, because the ordinary person reading it is not going to be impressed with you throwing a bunch of words in, which is what academics often tend to do. And then, you know, it's also really important. I think it's kind of a great test. Can you give examples that like stand up when you say, so here's a social dynamic that's taking place and so-and-so is talking about it. Let's see if we can find some examples. And then we look at them carefully and we say, well, I guess this one was, you know, as Plato called it, a wind egg, you know, or as we'd now call it, kind of, you know, essentially bullshit. And this one over here actually stood up. And I'll tell you another thing that's kind of a defining moment for me. I had a professor who specialized in, you know, contemporary French philosophy. And he did some critical theory as well, like Adorno. And he was a cool guy. And I remember we were in a Derrida class. And this is towards the end of his career. So he'd been doing this for years and years. And we're reading some of, at that time, Derrida's new stuff. And we went through a whole chapter, and he's like, you know, here's something I realized. You know, I was sitting at home and reading this book, and I got to the end of the chapter, and I felt so good about myself because I could figure out what all the references were and all the, you know, little plays on words and tricks and stuff like that. And I realized, I forgot to ask myself, is any of this stuff actually true? You know, because, you know, you get so happy about being like a member of the club, I guess you could say, the critical club, that you forget to ask, okay, so if this is like anything else in life, probably half of it is you know, off base, and probably half of it is good. So how do we sort that stuff out, you know?
Right. And you have to be able to communicate it as clearly as possible. I'm sounding probably like an analytic philosopher now, but you have to be able to communicate it clearly and rigorously, and you know, That could mean being a little bit less nuanced at times. In other words, just trying to get down to a basic argument first. I mean, remind yourself what's at stake about when you're talking about, I don't know, something like Kantian epistemology or Kantian ontology, that this, you know, I feel like, and this is probably my own eccentric, you know, unique, or not, you know, entirely unique, but somewhat unique perspective. But I feel like people forget that when you're asking epistemological questions, you're dealing with fundamentally a very simple problem, which is a problem of perception.
Yeah.
And all, you know, and these, you basically, do you know if you're dreaming or not? These kinds of, you know, college party questions are actually not that far away from a lot of very complicated epistemological arguments. And we kind of lose track of that over time.
Yeah. Or, you know, another example would be a friend comes to you and says that your spouse is cheating on you. How do you figure out whether that's actually the case or not? You know? Or think about, like, you know, food safety, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we've got all this information out there about what we should eat and what we shouldn't eat and how it's going to affect us. How do we know which of that is reliable and which of that is propaganda of one form or another? That's applied epistemology right there, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I like the science fiction gee whiz, you know, navel-gazing side of it. But you're right. There's some very clear examples. We're trying to figure out a solid epistemological approach to a problem is very important. You said you dealt with the people in the medical profession some, and that's of interest to me because my wife is in nursing school now.
We're
both middle-aged, and our kids are leaving home, and so she's decided, you know, I'm not going to hang around the house with you. I'm going to go get a job.
Well, that's very cool, you know?
Yeah. And so she's going through I sometimes annoy her, not just, you know, in the usual way, but in a particularly philosophical way, because she'll be going through and describing, say, patient-directed medicine to me, and I start to be skeptical. And you know, I start to ask, well, what was the method before, and why was it centered more on the doctor before?
Yeah.
Why, you know, what do they mean when they say patient-directed? Isn't there a problem because the patient isn't qualified to direct their own, you know, medical procedures? They don't have the knowledge to be able to make good judgments. That can, and
yeah,
you know, suddenly I'm putting, you know, gum in the works here. her job is not to go in and question the curriculum, but to learn it. But how do you find applying philosophical skepticism or rigor to in the realm of, say, medicine or big institutions goes over?
What philosophy deals with are the assumptions on which a great many normal beliefs rest. Not the sort of things which people like to dig up, because people sometimes don't really want their assumptions examined over much. Because people are rather uncomfortable when they're made to look into what really their beliefs rest on. But in fact, the sort of assumptions which a great many ordinary common sense beliefs rest are matters for philosophical analysis. When looked at, they turn out to be a great deal less secure and a great deal more complicated than they seem at first. And philosophers, by examining these, teach people self-knowledge. They explain to them, but very, sometimes very in a very illuminating way, what they believe and why they believe it. And this is a very central task.
We're all of us made very uncomfortable by having our assumptions examined, as you just say, by digging into the presuppositions of our own thought. And I think we all, beyond a certain point, resist it. Why do you think we resist it?
Well, of course, because people don't like being overanalyzed, I suppose, and partly because action itself, perhaps, precludes this kind of thing. Quite obviously, if you're simply actively engaged in some kind of life, constantly to be asked, why do you do this? Are you sure that what the girls which you're pursuing are true girls? Are you certain that what you're doing is not, in some way, doesn't contravene some kind of moral beliefs which perhaps you want to hold? Or are you sure that some of your values don't conflict with certain other values and you are simply not facing that? That sometimes when you are plunged into some kind of dilemma, you are so frightened of looking it in the face that you avert your gaze and try and get the responsibility upon some other back, on the back of the state, for example, on the back of your teachers, on the back of your class, on the back of some other association to which you belong. Shouldn't you perhaps face this responsibility? This, I think, daunts people, naturally creates resistance.
A lot of times when I'm talking about things, I won't mention where they actually come from until people get interested in it. So I won't tell them that an idea is coming from, you know, Aristotle or Aquinas or Nietzsche or whoever. Mm-hmm. I'll get them hooked in first, and then, you know, I'll say, well, here's some, you know, suggestions for reading, and here's some resources. And so there's that aspect. The other thing is, I would say that when it comes to other disciplines, you're right. Philosophy brings a kind of, I wouldn't call it skepticism in a dogmatic sense. It's more like a methodological, well, how do you know that that's actually the case? You know, what's your evidence for that? You know, we're kind of used to that. And that happens even, I remember going to parties with the English people, you know, in grad school, and they'd always get ticked off at us philosophers because they'd be like, oh, I read this book, I got this great interpretation of it, and all the English people would kind of rub their chins and say, oh, that's really cool. And we, you know, we'd be like, well, you know, here in the book, this person says this, so I'm not sure it's compatible. And then they'd be like, well, you know, you guys are not very good partygoers. So there's that aspect, right? And I think that does serve a valuable purpose. And I do see quite a few professionals in their fields who recognize that there's not enough of that in their fields. The second thing, though, I think we bring is, and I don't think analytic philosophers are any good at this, and I think some continental philosophers are quite good, some aren't. Historians of philosophy are the really good persons at this, in understanding those sort of questions, like how did the discipline develop? You know, what was it like before, and what ideas were flowing into that, and what brought about the changes, and are those changes for the better, or are you just, and here's the third thing, a lot of stuff in like ed theory, business theory, leadership is just the same stuff, you know, repackaged over and over again. And it's sort of like philosophy light, and they change the names of it a little bit, and then they, you know, package it because they're great at doing the marketing stuff. And we can look at that and be like, oh, yeah, that's just this theory, you know. And when we do that, they look at us like we're wizards, you know. Holy crap, you know, you unlock the code. And it's just because, you know, sometimes we have a little bit more knowledge of the history of ideas, or sometimes it's those dispositions that we learned. And again, I don't think that academic philosophy is necessarily doing a great job in inculcating those in people. Because, you know, academic philosophy is not geared towards producing practitioners who are going to go out there and do things with philosophy.
So you don't find that, because I find that when I was an employee, having too philosophical an attitude would be a good way to get fired.
Sometimes.
You know, Socrates was given the hemlock. So you don't run into a lot of opposition when you're out there. You've managed to navigate this well enough so that you're not telling people things they don't want to hear or questioning.
Well, I do tell people things that they're not happy about quite often. But, you know, generally, I'm enjoying a certain kind of prestige coming in as an outsider now. I'm sure you've seen this in places. Within an organization, generally what people in the lower parts have to say is going to be ignored. And especially academic institutions are terrible for this, you know. Now they bring in an outside consultant and suddenly the same thing. I saw this all the time when I was at FSU, you know. Bring in an outside consultant, whether they're paid or unpaid, and suddenly, you know, the administration is willing to listen. And what did you do? I mean, you could have actually just gotten a professor they don't know and put a different outfit on them, have them come in with some glossy stuff, you know, with some made-up name and say they're from this or that institute or, you know, organization. And they'd probably buy it because there's this tendency to think that, well, you know, if they're coming in from the outside, they're more objective. They, you know, we're actually paying for this. So there's a bit of that aspect, I would say. But, you know, the other thing is I've got this sort of track record, you know, what Aristotle would call an ethos of almost like scrupulous fairness. You know, you can see it in my videos. You can see it in book reviews. I tell people how, you know, I tell them how it is as best as I can see. And if they don't like it, that's, you know, up to them to then figure out what they're going to do about it. And so because I've put in the time to develop that ethos, I think people trust me more. Whereas if somebody else were to come in and just be doing the same thing, they might be seen as abrasive, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we should actually do a little bit of philosophy ourselves here. Because you made a claim there that I want to poke at a little bit, like
okay.
the claim that you were fair and objective, which, you know.
Well, I said I'm perceived as fair and objective.
Right. I'm not really going after you here.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But it's trying to figure out just what that means to be fair and objective is one of the problems of philosophy. And you've given lectures on Nietzsche and his view of truth. I think there was a YouTube video I have written down here about, it was called Nietzsche on Rationality, Abstraction, and Anthropomorphism, Philosophy Core Concepts. And I listened to that. I think you're, by the way, I just want to say, I think you're very, very good at taking complex ideas and making them accessible and interesting. So I agree with your self-assessment there, and people should go and watch your videos. But I thought to myself that Nietzsche's description of truth as a human structure that's built up over many years of human activity, through the use of codes and metaphors and analogies and symbols, is reminiscent but very different of some Hegelian and Marxist insights, namely that social reality is built up on codified human practices in the world. But the big difference between Nietzsche and Marx, from this perspective, is in how Nietzsche focuses on language and narratives, and Marx focuses on material production and the way we engage in with nature and you know, produce things physically. Did Nietzsche ever read Marx?
I don't know if he read Marx as such, but he certainly was aware of what was going on politically. I mean, you know, when we think about Marx's place in, you could call it the socialist spectrum, Marx and Engels were good at sort of colonizing it from the inside and taking it over. You know, when you look at the Communist Manifesto, and the third part is essentially why all the other socialists have got things wrong. You know, and you know, I don't looking at it in that way. I think Marx, in effect, was able to take over the movement for a while. So. You know, we can say the same thing about, like, did Nietzsche, you know, actually read Hegel? I don't know. But I know he would have encountered lots and lots of Hegelianism. And he even accuses his own work in you know, his retrospective on The Birth of Tragedy as being too Hegelian. But what exactly that means, you know, I look at it a lot as these great philosophers often wind up getting kind of what's the word? Boulderize. I might not be pronouncing it right. Where they're you know, they're kind of watered down into a William Durant style presentation, and then that becomes the popular thing. So like a lot of people learn what Nietzsche is through you know reading Chesterton's critique of Nietzscheanism or reading Shaw's you know essays or things like that. And I think it must have been quite similar with Hegel and Marx. And you're right. There are similarities between what Marx is, let's say, diagnosing, and what Nietzsche is as well. Nietzsche's not so concerned with, say, capitalism as such, but it's not like you'd have to push him that far to get him to be focused on that and seeing, you know, an abyss opened up, say, of meaning and things in late capitalism. And that's, you know, that's what the Frankfurt School successfully does, I think, when they're doing really great work, is brings together Marx, Nietzsche, Freud, and some other, I mean, with Adorno, pretty much everybody he can, right? Which is part of what makes it reading so tough. So there are compatibilities there, yeah.
Well, the problem I see in when you take this point of view on what truth is, that it's something that's a, sort of built up on practices, is that you have to develop a practice of truth seeking in order to discover this truth about truth. And you have to ask yourself where that came from. And you have to decide, you know, why your practice or your code is more objective or can see past the codes and practices that have informed your understanding of truth up to that point.
Yeah. So I should say that I don't actually endorse Nietzsche's sort of extreme conception of truth in Truth and Lies in an Extramoral Sense. I shoot videos on things, and whenever I am presenting something, I present it in its sort of strongest form. That's
right.
That's part of what I mean by myself being perceived as being objective. So I can, you know, if you like look across the spectrum of my videos, there's no way I could endorse even a quarter of the different positions that I've presented.
Sure, right.
But for me, it's important, especially for the beginners who are watching my stuff, to present it first and then we critique it later. And one of the common criticisms is, well, Dr. Sadler, you never get to critiquing, right? And I say, well, I don't have the time. But when it comes – so when it comes to, like, truth, this is actually something I've wanted for a long time to do some book writing about and just, you know, don't get to it very often. There's a number of different conceptions of truth out there and some great works on it. And I think that we need to almost eclectically combine them so that for some things, the correspondence theory of truth is exactly what we want, you know. And we can, you know, whose theory then, right? Are we looking at sort of a, you know, Thomistic view on it, you know, where somehow it'd connect with the divine mind, or do we want more, you know, more naturalized view or something like that? For some things, we do want to think of it in terms of coherence. We want to look at not just say, you know, a certain Nietzsche's perspective, or if we're talking about Marx in terms of truth, we can talk about, you know, economic basis and then ideological superstructure and critique of that. But I think we want to take into account what Heidegger has to say, you know, we don't want to like go whole hog into them and say, okay, Heidegger, totally right. Truth is aletheia. That's the most basic form. All the others are kind of superficial. You know, the history of Western metaphysics has just been one mistake after another, a productive mistake, but a mistake nonetheless. We don't have to follow him there, but we can say, yeah, he's got a great insight about that. And it, by the way, turns out to be one that's compatible with Anselm's own discussion of truth in the being of things, you know, in On Truth. So I think that we end up having – it gets very, very messy, right? And so a lot of people don't like that sort of thing. But we want to be able to combine them. And, you know, ultimately, if you picked somebody in the present who I would say my views on this are probably closest to, it'd be Alistair MacIntyre. You know, you figure out what's true in part by getting into the lists and you know, putting your views out there and having them subjected to criticism and trying to understand where the other person is coming from. You put them imaginatively, put yourself imaginatively into their view. And if you don't do that sort of thing, then you don't get to really say that you've found that your position is in some way better than theirs, you know. And it's an ongoing process. You know, it's iterative. This is where I think Habermas is also onto something, you know. Truth-seeking has to you know, be engaged with others, oftentimes others who are like, that person can't possibly be right, you know. But we gotta do some of that. And so, you know, I think a lot of people don't like doing that sort of thing, you know. That's kind of a turnoff to say that. So I don't know. Now I've
kind I'm interested in this because it's – as someone who's working in and around politics, I mean, I'm not in politics, but I – publish political books, and I have a very, you know, committed Marxist perspective, and this is how committed it is. I can call myself a wannabe Marxist because, like a good Christian, I'm always struggling to be to understand Marx rather than feel like I've ever arrived somewhere, right? You know, it's a continual process. So you know I'm a real zealot when I refuse the label of Marxist and want to be humble. It seems to me that in the realm of politics, even in the realm of political theory, there is a reluctance to engage in truth seeking, and the level that you're talking, and the way that you're talking about. I mean, people are very quick to say, you know, of their political opponents, they're just not worth considering. And on both sides. And I think it comes down to a feeling that given the truth, a kind of a Nietzschean assumption that given the truth is merely a practice or a code that people have held onto for practical and political and self-serving reasons, our job as people who are trying to deliver a new truth is to kind of win the war rather than discover something.
And that's something McIntyre himself says after Virtue and then in other engagements, that a lot of the sides that we see today are really at their core Nietzscheans without realizing it when it comes to that. or you know, he'll use the term emotivist. He's changed it to another E word recently in one of his newer books. But the basic idea is that, a lot of people, they're much happier with a us versus them. And, you know, you get to do whatever sort of intellectual inquiry or political organizing or, you know, fighting the good fight on your side and those other bastards, they're not worth listening to. And things are always, you know, way messier than that. And you've got bad actors on both sides. And so you can always find a reason to write off the other side, you know. So that's one reason why I can't align myself with either of our massive coalition parties, you know. And I can't find a third party that I'm really happy with either. So, you know.
Yeah, well, after the revolution, you know, you'll have a party you can believe in, comrade, or gulag.
Yeah, I was gonna say after the revolution. I mean, I'm a very useful guy, so that's why I've had so many interesting positions. So I could be used by the revolution, but I'd be one of those guys that as soon as things are sort of firmed up, they'd probably send me off. You know, yeah. I was gonna mention too, like with the thing about, you know, can you call yourself a Marxist? So I'm the editor of Stoicism Today, and I'm involved with the modern Stoicism organization. And I'm also I'm actually the resources director for the Stoic Fellowship. So you'd expect that I should be, in fact, an Orthodox Stoic, but I'm not because I'm an eclectic, sort of like Cicero, you know? Mm-hmm. And it always throws people, beginners, when they find out that the guy who's, you know, in charge of the main online magazine is not, you know, you could say a card-carrying member. Although, you know, in effect, I am a card-carrying member, right? I'm part of the organization. And mm-hmm. It's interesting because they'll say, well, I'm a Stoic, you know. Why are you in this position? And then we'll get to talking, and I'll find out that they know very little about Stoicism. Just, you know, they've read a few books or something, and they maybe read their way through the Enchiridion or the Meditations once or twice. And I'll say, listen, buddy, I'm not a Stoic, but I actually know and practice more Stoic philosophy routinely in my day-to-day stuff than you do who are claiming to be a Stoic, you know? And so I think a lot of times the sort of proof is in what we do, you know?
Right.
And we can have multiple allegiances that way, you know?
Well, isn't being an eclectic very much a Stoic kind of approach to philosophy in a sense? Am I wrong on that?
Well, there are some things on which... So I do a lot of work on anger management. And I got into that in part because I've been an angry person pretty much my entire life, and I wanted to get a handle on it. And there's like a whole backstory there. But long story short, the Stoics, they contribute a lot of really great techniques for anger management, but their view is that anger is always bad. And I don't hold that view. I'm more Aristotelian in that way. And the Aristotelians were the ones who they would like point at and say, don't be like those Aristotelians over there. So on that point, you know, I'm definitely at odds with them. I don't agree with them on that. And some of the other things with the emotions as well. On the issue of faculty psychology, the Stoics were against that. The Aristotelians, Platonists, you know, they were favoring that. And I don't think we have to have something exactly like that. But I think that maybe the Stoics were wrong about that as well. So I can't, you know, I mean, these are kind of big things in terms of it.
Well, yeah. My question is, I guess, about the epistemology of like Stoic epistemology, that their relationship to the truth would be such that they hold off claiming it final knowledge. But maybe you should refresh my memory about the difference between skeptics and Stoics.
Yeah, I mean, the skeptics criticized the Stoics on precisely that point, and the Epicureans, because they thought we could, in fact, have veridical sense knowledge. I mean, they were materialists, both of them. So they thought that we could, in fact, have what they called fantastike kataleptike, which means, like, you know, you can't be wrong about this. And they thought that both of those schools also believed in something kind of like what later thinkers will call innate ideas, although they're not exactly the same. So the skeptics went after them pretty hard on those points as well. You know, there is a real distinction between them. And, you know, like I said, I think you can combine them. Cicero himself is drawing on the academic skeptic tradition and identifies himself with the academy, although he also draws super heavily on Stoics, on the Aristotelians, the old Platonists. The only people he doesn't really like are the Epicureans.
So the Stoics believe that you can know things directly through the senses.
Yeah, but it's pretty rare that it happens, you know.
Okay, the Stoics are empiricists. They're going to show you. They're going to say this. Look, by virtue of you being part of the world, you're part of God. You're a citizen of the world. By virtue of that, you can understand the world. There are things that you can understand. Okay, if you try hard enough. They're going to say you belong in this world, not like Plato, where you come from somewhere else. No. You are from this world, the universe. Zeus is the universe. Zeus is your father, and you're part of it. All right, act like it, I'm going to say. Huh? That means we can know things. Nature will help us know things. All right, so this is a part where, that's basically, in a nutshell, their metaphysics. For them, when it comes to Stoic epistemology, they have a criterion of truth. How do I know something's true? What makes something true? And they call it the cognitive impression. All right? What we have as animals, and particularly as human animals, we have impressions. We get impressions. They call it fantasia, which basically means an impression or presentation. So, you can't help this. By virtue of being alive, you will get impressions. I have an impression that I'm in this room right now. I have an impression that the wall is white. I have an impression that I'm standing in front of you. I have an impression that I'm speaking. Now, not every impression is true, right? Sometimes the sun looks smaller than the house. Sometimes the stick looks bent in the water. But the cognitive, an impression that I can grasp, this means cognize or to grasp. The cognitive impression, the graspable presentation, this is what makes how I know something's true, all right? Now, they're going to say that I get impressions. And it's not that I just have to accept the impressions like a lower animal. Then I make judgments or beliefs about the impression, right? I can choose to assent or not assent or reject, we'll say, the impression. I can choose it. I say, this appears like this. And now, as a rational animal, I can say, yes, but you know what? I can use my brain and realize that it isn't. The stick is not bent. Okay? Whatever else. and I can choose to accept the impression or reject the impression. Okay, that's what I can do as a rational. This is what makes something true. And this is how I can know something's true.
Okay, let me just, I'm just trying to remember because, frankly, this is not my strong suit. I know the Stoics and the Skeptics through having read the Phenomenology.
Oh, yeah, that's Hegel. Like butchers them. He's doing something very interesting, but it's not a reliable read on either one. He gives a better read in his lectures on the history of philosophy and his lectures on the philosophy of history. There, he's a little bit. More, you know, closer to them. But he also says something really interesting in that. He says, you can't be a Stoic or a Skeptic or an Aristotelian or whatever you want, pick from ancient philosophy today, meaning in his own time, that the situation has changed too much and you'd essentially be like a walking anachronism, having ignored all this philosophical progress. So that's kind of an interesting point, you know?
Right.
I mean, it raises the question, well, could you be a Hegelian today then, you know?
Well, I don't think so. Today you have to be a Marxist.